Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 134. Hey, Matt, Jonah, and I are coming around the country to perform live for you guys. We'll do podcasts in front of you. You'll basically pay us like monkeys to do a podcast in front of you. But they're actually a lot of fun. We're going to be in Portland on the 22nd of this month. Then on November 6th, we'll be in D.C. and then Northampton, Massachusetts on November 8th. So come out and say hi. Hug us. We have new t-shirts. Take a picture with us. We'll sign your boobs, even if you're a dude. So get tickets and more information at Nerdist.com. Also, the Nerdist Way book is coming out November 1st. You can get details about that on Nerdist.com as well. And I'd like to thank our continuing sponsor to the Nerdist Podcast, GoToMeeting, with HD Faces now, high-definition group video conferencing. You can share any document on your computer screen with everyone in your online meeting, and you can see their immediate reactions in high def. Facial expressions express so much more than just, yeah, it's really great, Bill. So check it out now. You can use GoToMeeting for product reviews, demos, sales presentations, training sessions, status meetings, everything from your desk. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting. Hold all the meetings you want for one low flat rate. Phone and voice over IP conferencing is included for free. So visit GoToMeeting.com and enter the promo code Nerdist. And now let us get into the mindset of focusing on this episode, which is with the amazing and articulate and brilliant John Hodgman, one of my favorite people. If you go back and listen to our Neil Gaiman episode, you will learn that Hodgman should be feared and revered. We recorded this episode several weeks ago. There's actually an eerie amount of Steve Jobs talk in it. This is before Steve passed away. But I had held on to the episode. I was trying to get a little bit closer to the release of John's book, which is called That Is All, a book of final world knowledge. It's going to come out on November 1st, same day as my book. And so that's why I held on to it. Just wanted a little bit closer to John's book release. But here it is. Unfortunately, Matt Myra was not able to join us for this episode because he was sick. Somebody had the flu or something. So here it is, recorded at John's hotel room with Jonah Ray and myself. The Nerdist Podcast episode number 134. Fear Hodgman.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Oh, wait, I wasn't recording that at all.
Oh, well, start again. All right. So then, okay, all right. Waking
so you
live,
did the part about panic suites.
Waking live, move over
so
here.
So where do the pictures go in there?
John, I'm going to take 25,000 to 27,000 pictures of you and then drop them in and we're going to animate.
Right, because I'm on television.
Jonah, you're slurping. Jonah, you're slurping. You're slurping coffee.
Sorry. Edit point.
And we're starting. We are here in the mega suite of John Hodgman.
Well, wait a minute.
What?
It's a normal-sized suite.
Well, but if I lived in a third-world country, this, you know, I could raise a family in here.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And I do have bunkers for mules and chickens. What were we talking about before we started recording?
We were talking about
I said.
Do it again. I got nothing on that.
Okay, I said this place is awesome. You said this is my panic suite.
Right, we'll take it from there. I can do that.
Okay. What is this room?
Wait, that was a bad.
Wait, look, what? No. I don't understand.
Wow, this is a really nice suite here.
It's my panic suite.
So, John, you're saying that when you get nervous, you fly from your home in New York to LA.
I maintain safe houses.
Okay.
In every U.S. state.
But shouldn't it be like near your home in the vicinity of where you live?
Well, no, but when the coming global superpocalypse comes, I don't know whether I'm going to be in California or Massachusetts or New York.
What about Oregon?
No, those are the states.
Oh, okay, those are the three.
Oh, wait, I'm not recording. Oh, wait, I wasn't supposed to say that part. Wouldn't it be easier just to pull a Voldemort and divide your soul up into a series of Horcruxes that you place in objects around the world with spells guarding them?
First of all, every time you do that, you destroy your soul a little bit.
A little bit.
And, you know, you lose your nose.
Yep.
And I'm on The Daily Show, so I can't be going on there with, you know, slit nostrils.
Why couldn't you be slit nostrils on The Daily Show? I feel like that would be a really fun hook to have for a while.
Yeah, well, I could see that. Do you know what I mean? But I feel like so much anger has already been generated because I grew a mustache.
Yep.
I think to go with slit nostrils in the same year, I think it would just be...
Are people really that mad that you grew a mustache?
There are a couple of reactions.
Yes.
There are the people who go, and this is generated from Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I from Twitter, my everyday interactions with normal humans on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You're referring to me when you said that?
Sure, normal.
Okay.
My colleagues at the Daily Show with Jon Stewart,
sure,
and my family and friends,
mm-hmm,
and the reactions typically are about this: about 70% of them say, "Get that thing off your face, pedophile."
Right, comma pedophile in the vocative case, like we are addressing you.
So, yes.
Okay.
It's not like they have Tourette syndrome.
Okay.
Pedophile for no reason.
Yeah. Okay. I just say it in places. Yeah, I just say it sometimes in places. Yeah.
And then a certain portion. So that's about, I'd say, 70%. And then I would say about 20% are, what's up with that mustache,
mm-hmm,
yo?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Verbatim. They say that verbatim.
Those people are all Jesse Pinkman on Breaking Bad.
What's up with that mustache, bitch?
Not Aaron Paul. The character of Jesse Pinkman.
The character of Jesse Pinkman calls me up all the time.
Yeah. Hey, bitch.
And then, that's uncanny.
Yeah.
And then there are 10% who say, I really like that mustache, including my wife. And those are the liars.
I'll tell you why I like the mustache, because it is a robust mustache.
Yeah.
Like, it's not...
Robusto.
A robustache.
Yeah.
Some people, white guys, as we are very white guys.
Sure.
When they try to grow the mustache, it's very stringy.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's almost as... No, but you're still as full enough. Like,
if you let it go, you...
I have let it go.
Yeah.
And I notice you also go for the soul patch along with the mustache.
Yeah.
Do you feel...
That's more of a Van Dyke, though.
But I...
Isn't it?
No,
isn't it the Van Dyke with the mustache and the little piece under your lip?
I call it the Zappa.
No, because Van Dyke, you got to have some on the chin.
You got to have some chin action.
What was known in the late 90s and even on to today is a goatee.
In the 1790s? Or the? Do you mean the...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the 20th century.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I'm an expert in the 20th
century. Okay.
I know you love the 18th century.
I think it's so great.
Yeah.
I mean, Victorian children being punished. I mean, the mortality rate was laughably high.
Things were great for wealthy white people then.
Yeah, they really were great.
Okay. But I believe, and I'm going to stand by this belief.
Okay.
That what everyone has called a goatee since one emerged on Matthew Perry's face in Friends,
mm-hmm,
is a Van Dyke. And a goatee is simply chin hair. Nothing else. Mm.
Now, if I had a comedy record scratch to put on right now, I would.
Because I'm wrong?
No, because I think you've just rocked the facial hair world.
I've just broken popular culture.
A lot of people listening to this podcast just went, what the fuck?
Exactly.
Like in their buses or
easy,
in their
everybody.
Gyms.
I've caused accidents.
We should call Whisker Wars and let them know what's
Whisker
going on.
Whisker Wars.
I could be wrong, and I know that everyone will let me know that I am wrong, but I think that's what it is.
But John is an expert on everything. How do you feel that when people try to tell you something and you know you're right, do you respond to these claims or do you just kind of have to know, like, well, I know I'm right and that person is clearly having
a... I guess I am, like, for example, now when I'm really planting a flag on, mm-hmm, this definition of goatee,
yep,
which I realize is controversial.
It is.
I have to be. I am a little nervous about it. Mm-hmm. I confess to you.
Okay.
And I'm not like a normal like Jonah who would just say whatever he wants.
No.
It's everyone farts. Expects,
yeah. See, you don't even
wrong.
Know what's going to come out of this guy.
You weren't supposed to say farts then, by the way.
No.
Pedophile. I think you. By the way. That would be a fun way to find pedophiles is you just go into public and just say it out loud, like, pedophile!
Well, who looks
and
here,
then
looks,
someone who, like, him, get him!
Yeah. Get that guy in the trench coat running away.
With two little tiny sets of legs coming
now,
out from under
now
the
now, Jonah, go get my info box. Go get my mother box from the desk there. Yes, thank you. All right. Oh, someone's calling me. Sorry. Podcasting is more important than human connection.
I want to apologize for Matthew Myra, who is also usually on the podcast, who is such a huge fan of yours and wanted to come to this podcast.
Right.
Sorry. What I'm about to say sounds like bullshit. He actually did get food poisoning.
Oh, really?
He had gotten off work. And
my
was,
plan worked.
Yes. you've hobbled him.
I poisoned
intestinally.
I poisoned his figs while they were still on the tree. Since I knew he liked to pick them and prepare them himself.
I tell him not to pick the figs off the tree. I say, go to the farmer's market.
Yeah, exactly. Live in a place where we can do that. We don't have to pick fruit on the
tree. Don't pick fruit off the tree where you see John Hodgman nearby with a device, one of those tanks where he's spraying...
Just don't go into John Hodgman's property.
For that, yeah.
Property doesn't.
Don't go to New York. Don't come to John Hodgman's panic safe house.
Yeah.
Yeah. While you guys talk about this, I'm
what did you find out?
I'm going to go into the vault and tend to the stables here at the panic suite. and then I'll come back and I'm going to check my canned goods supply and then I'll come back.
It's so weird that he broke into the safe house's green room where he had the fig tree and then was able to pick it.
Yeah.
What do you call a safe in a safe house? Is it a safe house?
It's a safe house safe.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Safe house.
No. That would be a safe house inside of a safe house.
Yeah, I love the idea.
It would be a safe house. Once the idea of a safe house had become so common that people presumed that it wasn't actually safe, that was just a cliche, and you had to extra specify a safe house. No, I'm talking about a real safe.
This is a corner that I can go into that I feel particularly safe in so that my safe house has become something of a nesting doll paradigm.
Right, exactly. Or a safe house, or it's a safe house in the sense that it is protected from intruders, but you've also gotten rid of all of the sharp corners and open electrical outlets. It's a baby-proof safe house.
Yeah, you have to baby-proof your safe house.
Yes, exactly.
Because you don't know. If you're going to have to flee with a baby, it might not be your baby.
What if he... I mean, this is what that dude in
that
the
road, mustache would indicate that it's not your baby.
I don't know what that means. that was the classic miscalculation of the man in the road.
Yes,
that guy was not prepared.
Did you find out the Van Dyke information?
Yeah, I was correct.
You were correct.
Yes, I was correct.
So all this time, like all those Sublime fans who have been saying they have goatees.
But do you know what? It has become, a goatee has become, what's the word? A vulgar.
Stupid?
A vulgar common term.
Right.
Vulgar in the traditional.
Right.
Non-vulgar specific sense of common term for any kind of around the mouth facial hair.
Well, as humans, we're generally lazy.
It's used in the same way, like a martini.
Yeah, mean a beer or a wine,
exactly,
or a tea,
a mug full of dirt.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, martini is so ubiquitous in our language,
right?
Trace back again to the 1700s, arguably the best century,
where they didn't have actual glasses or cups; they just had sticks with plates.
Yep, sticks with plates, and then you'd have to lick. Yeah. You'd have to lick the.
You had to balance. You had to balance the plate, spin it.
Mm-hmm.
Put your drink on it,
yep,
and then get it off in centrifugal motion.
Yeah, because the liquid tangents off, and you just you have to guess. And the really wealthy people.
The Chinese invented that, of course.
Yes, they were really great. I just recently realized that nothing makes you feel more like an animal than when you're eating authentic Asian food, because they don't have a problem. Like, American food has a really good way of disguising that you're eating animals.
I was going to say, nothing makes me feel more like an animal than eating cat food.
You mean food made out of cats?
Traditional cat food.
But Asian food, they will just leave faces and lips on things, and like shrimp heads and duck faces. And you eat the eyes.
Do you know why?
No.
Because our culture, the food that we eat, right, that we think is normal in America, derives from a very specific food culture.
Mm-hmm.
of aristocratic food.
Okay.
In Europe, right? Now, look, we've both read Game of Thrones. We know what it was like in medieval Westeros, right? Lamprey pies and swan necks all day long. People used to eat all kinds of weird stuff.
Well, if you're fancy, sure. If you're a Lannister.
Yeah, but we had this idea this actually really goes back to the middle of the 20th century, mm-hmm. the century of which I am an expert.
Yep.
Middle-class America decided to de-vulgarize its entire culture. Mm-hmm. That is to de-ethnicize, to put behind it all peasant-type activities. Agrarianism, for example.
Sure, sure.
Everyone moved into homes. Mm-hmm. The idea that your home was your castle was this huge aspirational idea, right? Mm-hmm. That you were no longer gonna have truck with your father and grandfather who, like, would eat a fish head. Do you know what I mean?
You're talking like a post-World War II society when America
moving into the jet age, streamlining mm-hmm. Culture of all of its European ethnic sort of vulgarities. Mm-hmm. And which, you know, a peasant ethos of don't waste food.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Make your own stuff. Raise it. Grow it. Cook it yourself. Don't waste
Fuck all that stuff.
Yeah. No. You know what? It's a modern age. We're going to go to the supermarket. We're going to press a button. We're going to get a thing out of a machine that looks like food.
Yep.
And then we're going to go home and we're going to heat it up in a microwave or in an oven and eat it in front of the TV.
That's
the future.
I thought the whole idea of eating a whole animal was that you can't dominate an animal any more than by eating its face, and by ingesting its eyes, you get to taste the last thing the animal saw before it died. Do you feel like that's true?
Yeah, and you get to see it too.
Yeah, for just a second. It's just a second, though.
Yeah. That's what the Chinese get to see.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
When you burp,
that's what non-Western cultures and people who are
quack. Right, excuse me.
Right, but our whole food ways, like what we consider to be normal food in America, comes from this '50s idea of getting rid of anything that smacked of peasantry,
mm-hmm.
and becoming modern, divesting ourselves from this concept of actually being in the world.
But you also mentioned like the people moved away from what their grandparents did.
Exactly.
And was that also a big thing of just like, you know, because I grew up in Hawaii where people, you know, there would be three generations in every house.
Right.
And was that another thing that happened? Like,
yeah, well, they threw their grandparents into a home.
Yeah.
So they would
literally move away physically and just culturally.
Yeah. Because that whole idea of generations living together became unpalatable.
Thank God.
Well, I'm not saying that everything was wrong.
I do think it's very funny that that as evolved as we think we are, that so much of American culture has its roots in basically Victorianism. That this whole sort of
ties.
Weird. Well, not just ties, but just it's a very stuffy,
right?
Kind of a tight-assed attitude. That came out of you know, like Queen Victoria kind of taking England by the balls and being like, you're going to fucking act right. But she didn't say it that way, because that would be anti-Victorian.
Yeah. But that's the hypocrisy of Victorianism. She probably did say it that way.
She probably said, you stuffing cunts.
Yes, exactly.
Let's clean this shit pile up.
Right. You pigs and garters.
Yes.
Right. She used Cockney rhyming slang, I'm sure. You pig and whistles.
You twats and swats.
What?
Yeah.
You chav.
What? don't bring your boffinry in here. There's another word I learned recently.
Well, people in the United States didn't have Christmas trees.
Right.
Until they saw, what's his name? Albert, Prince Albert.
Mm-hmm.
The Queen's consort. The German she married.
Yeah.
The Druid who first brought a Christmas tree into...
There's one in every house.
Lancaster House.
Yeah.
And there was a big picture of it in magazines. And everyone in America said, this is the beginning with the fascination with the royals.
Mm-hmm.
The perverse idea that we should find these people attractive. These people that we specifically formed our nation to get rid of them.
Sure.
All of a sudden, we aspire to be them.
Hey, abuse wife syndrome. You just don't know him. You just don't know England like I do.
Yeah, come on.
He's cool. England's cool.
I was hanging out with England again. Don't stop. Stop hanging out with them.
Listen,
then
fine. You're going to get what
England,
you deserve.
Yeah, England called me again.
Why?
Hang on.
You need to block the number.
I can't believe this.
What does England want now?
You're not going to get back together.
No, we're still friends.
You're not going to get back together.
We just enjoy texting one another and occasionally...
Do you mean sexting?
What's that?
Do you mean sexting?
Texting to arrange sexting.
Yeah.
Wait, so that's pre-sexting texting?
Prexting.
You're prexting.
Yeah.
For later sexting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any post-coital sex?
Too much lingo. I'm not young.
Okay. I love the idea that...
I took it as far as I could.
And that was it.
Yes.
Christmas trees in the home in the early part of the 20th century, where they would just, like, put candles on. So much of everything before, like, 1950 just looks incredibly flammable to me. Like, it was a period of time where people really seemed to not have a concept of, oh, all the... Like, the idea that, you know, some like, a lot of the early Ringling Brothers, or, like, a lot of the early Barnum display, like, where they would do these indoor... Everything was made of wood.
Right.
And they all burned.
Yeah.
They all just burned to the ground. So the idea of bringing
were very common.
Trees and homes and putting candles on them. Brittle... Dry trees.
Yeah. Oh, but then when things got modern, right? When Americans in the 50s and 60s started saying we can't do this anymore, that Prince Albert tricked us all into being druids and bringing live trees into our homes to kill us at night.
Yep.
We need to modernize. We're going to use fake trees. Mm-hmm. How about a tree made out of flammable film? How about a tree made out of old newspapers soaked in kerosene?
I have a better idea. Asbestos. It's good for the kids.
It's good.
It doesn't burn.
That won't burn. Exactly.
It smells great.
The base is made out of lead.
Yeah. It's just like, it hugs your lungs when you breathe it in.
It was such a weird time where it's like, anything artificial is good. Do you know what I mean?
No, they would get the big tree, and then they were like, oh, you know what I miss? The tree smell. Well, here's an aerosol can full of tree smell.
But how much fun was it for our society to discover plastics and to say, like, hey, fuck Bakelite. It's heavy.
Right.
It Please looks good.
Not on my watch. Don't ever say fuck Bakelite on my watch.
I was saying that's what they were saying. Okay, I am a huge Bakelite fan.
Yeah,
Chris,
course.
You were just talking about the other day how you hate Bakelite.
Jonas,
what the?
Fuck up,
well,
dude.
I'm sorry.
Right
I just, I think with... Transparency.
Did you see his mustache curl in anger? So you were out here for the Emmys?
Wait a minute, I thought we were talking about Bakelite.
Well, I want to turn the Emmys into a Bakelite award show.
I'd like to see where you're going with this.
I want to turn the Emmys into a Bakelite award show, and I want you to host it. That's why Joe and I are here. We're from the ABS, the American Bakelite Society. We wanted to start giving out the Bakeys. Of course, the award is made of Bakelite.
Right, of course. Yeah.
And all the seats are made of Bakelite, and most of the celebrities will be cast in Bakelite.
I think they'd like that.
Do you think that would be good?
Sure.
I think it might be more entertaining than the actual Emmy broadcast.
What, if the entire audience
was made out of Bakelite. Yeah, at least there would be a reason for them to seem
I think they would have shown more interest.
Now, I went to the Emmys a couple years ago.
I saw you there.
That's right, I did see you there. You were doing announcing stuff on the Emmys, and you were great.
You're nice. Thank you.
You really were.
You agree.
Jonah, you didn't even see it.
I also thought you were great.
Jonah, I'm positive you didn't see it.
I just wanted to say I'm nice.
You didn't see it.
It's true. I saw it online.
Jonah, you're Hawaiian.
We say that to him a lot.
Did he really grow up in Hawaii?
He really did, yeah. He grew up in just outside of Honolulu?
No, in the suburb inside in Kailua.
Ah, it's all the same.
Windward
what?
Side.
No, it's not.
It's not the same. It's quite different.
Could I see your birth certificate, please?
It's actually a certificate of live birth.
Whoa.
Yeah.
They write it on a coconut leaf.
I just drove a Bakelite wedge between you two. Now you'll never know if you can believe this guy.
You're never going to be president, Jonah.
Fuck.
I know.
You were saying?
I was saying I went to the Emmys a couple years ago, and I thought they were kind of fun, but there is a certain... That theater is massive.
The Nokia theater.
Yes, is massive, and there's just a lot of disinterest. People chit-chatting the whole time and not really paying attention. And then part of me is just like, why go? Like, make it smaller. Don't invite as many people. Just have the people there who should be there. I had no right to be there. I wasn't nominated for anything.
I know. I asked that you be taken out.
It didn't work.
Live on the broadcast, too.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe that's why you didn't go back.
Chris Hardwick is in the theater. Please tackle him.
John, we can't cut because this is live. What you're doing is bullshit right now. You've just wasted a break.
Bring me Hardwick.
No, you're all insane. I was a guest of someone who was actually working on the show.
I know who you were a guest of.
Yes.
The host of the show.
Yes, I was a guest of Neil Harris's. So.
Why did you not want to say that?
Because I didn't...
Because you don't want people to think that you truck in favors?
I don't...
You're trying to create the image that, like, you're friends with, like, the lighting dudes?
We're all good friends, and we just sit around and talk about Bakelite and,
yeah,
you know,
and
Victorian problems.
Yeah. I'm friends with the Bakelite grip at the Emmys. And
there's
so
a special one. He's a union guy.
You didn't want to say you were friends with the big star.
Yeah.
He's the reason that I was there.
Oh, really?
He suggested that idea that someone come on and do... hilarious announcements as people walk to the stage.
I thought he did such a great job hosting the show. He's such a sweet guy.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
I love him too.
So you went, I assume, with
too bad he's not a listener to the podcast.
I know, it's too bad.
I just presume.
I presume no one's really listening to the podcast
most of the time, but there are
people out there apparently. But I just always assume no one's going to hear any of this. All the time on the show, stuff gets said, and I'll go, I'll cut that later, and then I never do because I'm like, who's really going to care?
Right.
Who's really going to care?
Like your plans to murder Neil Gaiman.
Oh, see, I'm going to have to cut that.
I know.
I'm going to have to cut that if he were a listener.
Right, but
he's not.
No.
So the plan's going to be executed fine. So this is what we're really talking about. I don't think Neil has a safe house. So
let me tell you something. I'm a little alarmed.
What?
Because, you had a podcast with Neil Gaiman.
I did.
Which I enjoyed very
much. Oh, thank you.
And then all of a sudden I had one of those fall off the treadmill moments when you guys were suddenly talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did not expect.
Yes.
It made me very nervous.
No, believe in the Hodgman.
But I was very flattered. Thank you very much. And Neil said some very nice things about me.
Yes.
And I thought, this is great. I have now just tricked Neil Gaiman into giving a blurb for my new book.
And did it work?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And so I wrote him and I said, Neil, thank you for saying those nice things. Would you mind if I use this flattering quote in my new book?
Mm-hmm.
That is all. Yep. Available on November 1st.
November 1st. Our books are coming out the same day.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We're going to have a party.
Ooh, have a party.
It's like when Oasis and Blur put out singles on the same day. I wonder who's going to sell more.
Well, John and I don't hate each other, and we don't have soccer matches against each other.
So you're Blur, obviously. So what do you...
I'm Blur and Gorillaz.
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing. So you come back in the
fourth quarter. Yeah, I come back. Yeah, exactly.
I'm following along. I'm getting it. I'd like to go back to Bakelite, please. References that I understand. From the 20th century.
All right, I'm sorry. Well, now Oasis and Blur were from the 20th century.
I know. Just not my 20th century.
I guess that's true, yeah. They were not in your...
I know the contours of what you're talking about.
The 20th century. Yeah.
But anyway, so I said, Neil, do you mind if I use this nice flattering thing? He said, that would be great. It would also be great if you credited it to the Nerdist podcast.
He said that?
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so I said, no.
He
said, no, but yes. And so it is.
Oh, my gosh. That's
so
fantastic.
Neil Gaiman said?
I said on the Nerdist podcast, yes.
That is very nice of him.
That's in the inside, and me.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, you kind of had to have your arm twisted a little bit. I mean, if we're going to be, he wouldn't have let you use the quote if you didn't. It's like, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, I guess you get some credit for it, but really.
Chris, we are guests in John's panic room.
Yeah. Panic Suite.
Sorry, please. Panic Suite.
It's more than one room.
That was the sequel to Panic Room.
Sweet.
They go on vacation afterwards. She's like, it looks like everything's going to be okay. Uh-oh.
Jodie Foster had a fun run of I'm trapped in a thing and I have to solve a thing movies. Like, it was Flight Plan.
Of two.
Flight Plan was the other
Panic
one.
Panic Room and Flight Plan.
Yeah.
That's not a run.
It's a mini. It's a jog.
It's a mini. Yeah.
It's a stroll.
She had
a light stroll of I'm trapped in a thing. By the way, do you think you could convince someone they were crazy if they fell asleep and you took their kid away and went, you don't have a kid? How long before they would start?
You never had a child. Is that what happened in Flight Plan? You never had a child.
Yeah. Like they fall asleep. She designs this large. Spoiler alerts. She designs this large plane and she is on the plane on its inaugural flight. Someone plans some sort of a heisty thing, and she falls asleep, and she wakes up, and her child is gone. And everyone on the plane is like, you didn't come in here with a child. And then, so...
But they didn't tell her, you never had a child.
Yes.
They tell her that?
They try to convince her that she's crazy.
Really?
That her child either was dead or didn't come along.
Does she say the line, give me back my son and get off my plane?
No, because it was a daughter, and that would be weird. Oh, and they'd be like,
I was just hoping she was
See, you're
take...
crazy. You thought you had a daughter, now you say you have a son?
No,
You were crazy, Jodie Foster.
Anyway, margaritas when we land, right, guys? And then the movie just credits roll.
But fast TV style credits.
Yeah, but in like 38 specials, Take Me Back to Paradise.
Does it turn out that her daughter was a ghost?
Her daughter was not a ghost.
Does it turn out her daughter was a snake?
No, her daughter was not a snake on a plane, nor was a daughter a ghost, nor was Jodie Foster. The ghost, but and didn't realize she was the ghost.
Right.
What about was the baby, her daughter, a goblin on the wing of the plane?
Who was
tearing out? No one would believe. They're like, there's nothing on the wing.
Was Jodie Foster either William Shatner or John Lithgow?
Jodie Foster was John Lithgow, who William Shatner raped on the flight's pinball machine.
When does Dan Aykroyd show up and say, "Do you want to see something scary"?
That was he said that to the pilot.
Okay.
Because he shut the plane's headlights off.
Wait, Dan Aykroyd?
Yes,
was
Dan Aykroyd.
Was he a great big fat person? He was.
That was a gorgeous Jodie Foster ring that we've just.
That was a run.
That was a good run.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was a run.
That was a better run than Jodie Foster's "I'm trapped in a thing and have to solve a thing."
Yeah,
which we determined was not a run.
It was the titular line of that movie. "I'm trapped in a thing and I have to solve a thing."
That should have been the third one if she had done another thing.
That was a run. That was a run in the sense that sometimes you go for a run, and I do these things. You know, I move around from time to time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you go for a run and you get put on your headband and your wristbands and your jogging shorts
and your shin bands. Do you put your shin bands on?
My shin bands and your whole gym fix running outfit.
Are you running in a Wes Anderson movie? Is that where you're taking a run?
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, you get all ready to go and you limber up and then you run out the door and you're like, oh, fuck this.
Yeah, and then a song, I don't feel like this. Some sort of a kitschy song.
You get halfway around the block, you're like, oh, I'm going.
Yeah.
A zombie song plays, like something off of Odyssey and Oracle.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Give me some coffee.
Yep. Yeah. Give me some coffee.
But the point I was making was this. There were two quotes that Neil had made that I liked for the book. One was a very flattering quote, which was the one that I asked him about. But then there was another thing he said, which was, which I thought would be a great quote out of context. If you meet Hodgman on the road, kill him.
Yes.
Which is a reference to a Buddhist koan.
Mm-hmm.
If you meet Buddha on the road, kill him.
Oh, yes. That does sound familiar.
Which is I had to look that up. I didn't know what it was.
I didn't know either. I thought Neil wanted to kill me. No, he doesn't. Yeah, okay. He was referencing.
So then I thought, okay, it would be funny to on the back of the book where my photo is, just as the caption, the only line, if you meet Hodgman on the road, kill him, Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me permission to do that as well. I thought, that's great. Now I got two Neil Gaiman blurbs.
Yeah, that's a two.
Nerds have to buy this book now.
Do you?
But then I got the cover and I looked at it, and for the first time it occurred to me, I'm afraid someone's going to try to kill me.
That's what I was curious about. Yeah. That when your book says, if you meet Neil Gaiman, said, yeah. Neil Gaiman has.
If you meet Hodgman.
Essentially ordered your death.
Yeah. It may be that I have overestimated Americans' familiarity with Buddhist koans.
And irony.
And Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So, that's
I don't know who this Neil Gaiman is, but it's someone of authority, obviously, and he wants me to kill this guy.
It says
here's a picture of him.
And so he looks like a guy, when they show the picture, it's like, apparently this man ordered the death, and then just, you see Neil Gaiman, like, yeah, makes sense. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, thank you, Neil, and also, everyone, please don't murder me.
Tell me about, I want to hear about your book.
Well, Chris... Let me put down my coffee.
That was a very Tuesdays with Maury.
Yeah.
kind of a slurp, the coffee cup goes down.
Yes.
I remember things from the 20th century.
In the 20th century, we had things called books.
Snore. Boring.
In the early 21st century, I wrote two books.
Yes.
Of complete world knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing, true facts and fascinating historical trivia all made up by me. The areas of my expertise was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
More information than you require was the second one. Mm-hmm. And it was always planned, Chris, always, that there would be a third.
Unlike Jodie Foster.
Yeah, I was going to have a run. Not a jog.
Mm-hmm.
Not a stroll.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have a run of books.
Of fake trivia books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Two would be a brace.
Yep.
Three. Three is a trilogy, and that's what you need in order to make it today in book publishing.
Now, in the third book, is that where you storm the castle after claiming the sword? Because you're the king and you have the army of the dead fighting for you? Or am I thinking of a different trilogy?
I think you're thinking of a different trilogy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you didn't write Tolkien's books?
I did not write Tolkien's books, nor did I write the Army of Darkness.
It's not a sword, though. It's
the Evil Dead.
It's the
Necronomicon.
I didn't write the Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Right. But speaking of the
Necronomicon. You didn't write the books that those movies were based on.
I want to hear where you're going with speaking of the Necronomicon.
Speaking of the Necronomicon, my book.
Which also
technically orders your death, so it is kind of a book of the dead.
It is a book of the dead.
Yes.
In the sense that I had written these two books, and with the first one, it was easy. I was just writing every joke that I had ever made in my life and never had a chance to say.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? And I loved it, and it was fun, and I got to create all this fake history about hobos and the Loch Ness Monster and all this stuff that I found to be fun for me. And that was simple. It truly was just like the areas of my expertise, like everything, this is what I know.
Mm-hmm.
These are the crazy, that's the worst thing that a anyone can, any writer can say, these are just the crazy things that are in my brain.
How do you come up with this stuff?
It's just the wacky stuff that's in my brain.
How did you come up with
this? These are like every poor, half-formed, dumb idea that I've ever had goes down on paper in a list form, and then it gets published. But it was wonderful.
The second book, I was really nervous about how to do more because I felt like I had already written everything I knew.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You know, the secret to writing is write what you know, but the double secret is learn no different stuff.
Yeah, but then once you write everything you know, then you got to go into your brain's panic suite.
Yeah, exactly.
And draw from that knowledge that you're hiding from the rest of your brain.
Right. Write what you know, but don't be boring.
Right.
No interesting things.
The second book is like that book report in grade school where you didn't know what to write about, so you wrote about the writing of the book report.
Yeah exactly. And then the second book, I was in my panic suite. But then I realized, like, it was almost as though I hadn't realized that my whole life had transformed.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had gone on The Daily Show to promote my first book.
Mm-hmm.
And that had changed my life completely. And suddenly I was no longer a writer of magazine articles and food columns for magazines. But mm-hmm. I was on TV. And then I went on those Apple ads.
Mm-hmm.
Those Apple ads. Why am I so dismissive of them?
Yeah. Then I went on to My Life's Work.
Yeah. I'm not familiar.
The greatest job I ever had in my life that I miss every day.
Did you do some work with a fruit-themed company?
I did, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I hope to do more. That is Fruit of the Loom. I'm going to do some, some Fruit of the Loom ads in Japan.
It's like, hey, I'm Boxers, this is Briefs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then some other weird guy, like, I'm Boxer Briefs.
Right. I'm doing some work in Japan for a company that has bought the Fruit of the Loom brand. They're licensing the Fruit of the Loom brand to create adult diapers. It's going to be great.
And that you could just keep on being in commercials then, because it only becomes more relevant.
Yeah, I play all the fruits.
That's going to be fallen fruits of the loom, because you can't control when the fruit falls out of the tree.
Low-hanging fruits.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds much better than the original Japanese.
Right.
Just, but it's all the fruit bundle, the logo is just prunes and raisins.
Yeah.
Sure, with dates.
Yeah.
Dried apricots. The worst.
Mm-hmm.
Pineapple rings.
Apple chips.
3-day old.
Yeah.
Pineapple rings. So
fruit
you
leather.
You did that. That.
See, my new shoes are made of fruit leather.
Really? I'm in S&M. I only have fruit leather.
Yeah.
I love that. I mean, the Apple ads, it's interesting, the whole concept that, I mean, because there was a period of time when commercials could change people's lives. And then as we became,
I think Justin Long and I changed a lot of lives.
Well, that's what I'm going to say, though.
Touched a lot of people.
As we sort of drifted into a DVR culture,
right?
Commercials became less and less, you know.
You had to watch them.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but those ads.
They became less and less you had to watch them.
Less and less you had to watch.
More and more, hey, maybe not.
Maybe I just wanted to skip to this other part of this show.
Is there a grammatical explanation for the using of phrases as adjectives? Do you know what I mean? Like, instead of like, they became less and less relevant,
right.
And more skippable.
I know that
less and less you have to watch them. More and more, hey, maybe not.
I remember the literary tools of metonymy and synecdoche.
A pie.
Where I and
the
I
two can't, hands met.
Yes,
synecdoche.
Where I, but I think metonymy isn't something metonymous if you use, like, when you say, hand me that Kleenex, but it means any tissue, like one name. Oh. Represents an entire.
Well, synecdoche. Oh.
Is in upstate New York. Come on. What? Don't. Why are you vomiting?
Because he's worried that we're going to make a reference to the movie?
Well, it's just. I didn't see.
What's wrong, John?
I just feel bad that people don't know that that's a literary term.
Synecdoche?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just a city or a movie?
They think that it's either an actual city mm-hmm. now.
Yeah.
When it's a play on Schenectady,
uh-huh.
a city that a lot of people don't know about, and a literary term a lot of people don't know about, so it's confusing. And now people don't realize that that's a good literary trope.
Well, the little brains don't, as Albert Brooks called them. But I think some people do. And hey, listen, if it makes people look something up, then you have taught them something.
I say some of these listeners don't really know what it is.
Well, look, just because I obviously know the difference between synecdoche and metonymy, but to help the listeners,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to get out my mother box and double check.
By mother box, you mean your brain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. What passes for my brain?
How's your connection in here? All right, well, John's punch card is now coming out of his slot.
It's really amazing that his brain is a computer, but it's like a really old computer.
Right, part of something.
Part. Hodgman's vacuum tubes.
It's a figure of speech in which determine part of something is used to refer to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
A thing is used to refer to part of it. Pardon me.
Like so the crown. The crown
represents
orders,
royalty.
Orders the king or the
right,
realm.
Right. Right. And I think
by order of the crown.
And I think metonymy is one of a group of things represents the entire group,
you know,
of
what?
Things.
I think you're probably right.
That's right.
Exactly.
That sounds all right.
Well done, Van Dyke.
Thank you very much. I'm not even Van Dyking today at all. I look terrible with any kind of goatee, mustache, Van Dyke. I just go for the
fantastic.
But I just go for the haven't shaved in a while thing.
Yeah, yeah. It looks good. Jonah looks terrible.
I feel okay with it.
I almost shaved today, but then when I shave my beard, yeah, I leave the mustache and soul patch for a bit, but I didn't want to show up with that.
Why? That would have been hilarious.
I know. I got shit from Mark Maron.
Well, that's weird because he's usually like, so inviting
and
warm.
Yeah. Oh, mustache and the thing, huh? Yeah, I get what you're doing.
Wait a minute. Oh, so Mark Maron looked at you and saw a picture of himself somehow?
Somehow he saw, yeah.
Oh, I'm angrily lashing out and I'm actually trying to connect with you, but it comes off like bitterness and anger. Yeah, I get what you're doing.
Yeah. And then I took it off because we were doing a show a few days later. I was like, I don't want to have to deal with that before my set. And I took it off and he's like, ah, you took it off. You look good with it. Fuck you.
So I did these ads and they changed lives, as we both were saying.
Yes.
And they certainly changed my life.
Yes.
And it made it very complicated to write the second book because I was still writing from the point of view of the first book, this sort of like loser literary freelance writer, dilettante. Do
right.
you know what I mean?
Right.
And in the first book, I would write jokes like, here are five movies that I've made a cameo appearance in, because that was a ridiculous thing to contemplate when I was writing the first book. But in the second book, I couldn't make that joke at all because I had had a cameo appearance in at least one movie
right.
at the time. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So the weirdness of my life was outstripping my ability to make up crazy facts about it.
Absolutely.
And I had to reposition where I was. And so I was able to... That was the breakthrough there where I was like, oh, now I'm writing not as a professional writer, but as a famous minor television personality. Mm-hmm. And that's going to inform the stuff that I talk about and look at and everything else, and that was great. Well, I did that, and then now the third book, I had to write the third book, and I didn't know what the position where I was writing from was, so I had to look at my own life. The ads were over.
Mm-hmm.
My life was over. By which I mean, I was at that time about to turn 40 years old.
Mm-hmm. Did that bother you?
Of course.
Does it still bother you?
Perhaps unlike you, I am mortal.
No, I am mortal too, but I never realized that until last year when I started to see that number coming down the pipeline and then started to go, oh yeah, there's an end point. There is an end point to all this. When you're young, when you're in your 20s, you're just like, I'll figure that shit out later.
Yeah.
And then you start to feel like,
oh yeah.
Oh no, there's no later.
There's not a lot of later left.
There is not a lot of later.
Exactly. And yeah, and it's chilling to think about.
It really is. Like, something biologically weird happened. I mean, don't freak out if you're about to turn 40, because everyone who does get over the hump, then they go like, ah, okay, it's not a big deal.
Nope.
It was weirder when
they're lying. How old are you?
I'm 39.
Yeah. 39 is the hard one. 39 is... I mean, it is... I guess you're right. Now that I'm 40, I'm comfortable with my impending death in a way that I wasn't.
I was more freaked out about it last year.
39, yeah. But that's where you feel like you're watching the last grains of sand in the hourglass.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
When, in fact, it's actually not true because, I mean, I see people 55, 58, 60 years old now. I mean, I think we have this idea of the previous generation... You know, even now we're living these 20, 30-year extended adolescence.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah,
right.
Where we get to live as selfishly as possible.
It's great. It's a good time.
Where, you know, previous generations were like, nah, you work and it sucks and you hate it and you got to give shit to your family and you don't want to and they just fucking stare
you just
at you like these
Pepitone.
Parasites. Yeah. Yeah, you turn into Eddie Pepitone.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's as bad. I don't think it's as bad for us as it was for previous generations.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think there is I call me crazy, but I think there's something
crazy
in humans. Something about humans, they don't, they're afraid of death for some reason.
Well, because we have to have this we have to have this kind of biological mechanism that makes us inherently want to survive.
Yeah. And procreate.
And procreate, right. and form a society, and, you know, otherwise it just all falls apart. I mean, if you we don't have that mechanism, then why do anything? Why follow rules? Why live? Why fucking get a job? Like, I don't know. It's just...
Yeah, man.
What?
I like that, man. Man. Yeah, you guys...
No, Jonah's shaving as I'm telling. I'm really glad to him. He's putting on a tie. Man. Going to work.
Fuck this comedy shit.
Right.
So, anyway, so you...
Oh, so, yes.
So, 40, so not, the ad... Right, how long did the ads run?
4 years.
Wow.
It was like college. It was like, you know how you feel at the end of college? Like, yeah. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
That's how I felt.
And did you have any sort of, did they have any creative input in the ads, or were they very much like, stand here, say this, as you can say, what was the process of the commercials like, and how did it evolve?
Well, they were written very smartly.
Mm-hmm.
The director was Phil Morrison,
mm-hmm.
Who is a really great director and was, you know, instrumental in teaching me essentially from scratch how to act,
mm-hmm.
in those ads. And that was just to feel comfortable. And he worked really hard to make sure that we had a lot of takes and that we got to fool around as much as possible. Because even though usually, very rarely would our ad libs come into play in the ads,
mm-hmm.
being able to do that, we could just, it created a sense, an air of spontaneity and intimacy,
sure.
that read. Even when we eventually worked our way back to the
right.
scripted language. So, yeah. But we had... I mean, it was fun. It was just so much fun. I remember when I was a young person,
mm-hmm.
and the TV show Cheers was...
Like 39?
Yeah, exactly. no, like when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and the TV show Cheers was ending,
mm-hmm.
and every person to a man or woman on that cast was just like... This was the greatest time I had in my life. All I had to do was show up with people that I like and have fun all day mm-hmm. long, and then go home and count all my syndication money.
When the deals were really sweet back then.
But yeah, by the end of the show, I mean, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That was, everyone was in their pure, you know, and pure comfort. You know what I mean? They're like, everyone was totally comfortable with themselves.
Except for Shelley Long,
lives.
Who left.
I'm sure she's fine.
Yeah. She has all that outrageous fortune money.
But I was like,
it's called outrageous,
you know, I remember sitting at home going, I wish that could be my life. Just show up and have fun with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And and even so, it was said in the context of how unusual that is, even for making a comedy.
Yeah.
That you like the people that you're with, and the creative team is great, and you feel supported, and you just have fun all day long. I was like, it's more than anyone can hope for, but that's something to shoot for.
Mm-hmm.
And very... unexpectedly, I mean, in every way, that ended up being my life on those ads. It was just like, I love Justin, I love Phil, I love all the creative people, the people that I would hang out with, the crew who was there almost on every shoot. We all became very friendly with each other, and it was fantastic, and we would have a great time.
Did you ever meet Steve Jobs?
No.
Never?
No. I had one opportunity to do so, and I blew it, because it was right when the iPhone was coming out.
And there was a Small Wonder Marathon, and you love the 20th century.
The iPhone was coming out, and I was at the Daily Show, and Jon Stewart said, you know, Steve Jobs is coming here on Monday. Now, I only go to the Daily Show to do my bits,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'll go in for a day or two and work on my piece and do my piece, and then that's it. I'm not in the office otherwise. So I don't know what's going on all the time. So he said, Steve Jobs is coming in on Monday. I said, oh, wow, is he going to be a guest on the show? He's like, no, he's coming by to show us the iPhone and visit.
Wow.
You know.
Jesus.
And I'm like, wow. Cool. And he's like, you know, Jon Stewart said you should come by and say hello. And I'm like, oh, I don't know, because I wasn't scheduled to be in that day.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure I want to poke my head into that meeting and go, hello.
Perhaps you recognize this, indicating to face.
It's me.
Hey, Steve, I'm a PC.
Yeah. And John was like, no, you work here. You know, you have every right to be here, obviously. You should come in on Monday and we'll, you know, I'll bring you in. So I'm like, oh, thanks, John. Let me think about that. I'm not sure. I'll let you know.
What were you nervous about?
Well, this was early on in the run, right, of the ads.
So you didn't want to say the wrong thing.
Yeah, I didn't want to say the wrong thing.
Nice to meet you, Steve. Your face smells. Oh, my God. Why did I say that?
It's a weird thing.
It had been about a year. My life truly had changed completely. Mm-hmm. Like, I really had an idea that I was going to be a writer of a freelance magazine writer for my whole life. And if I were lucky, I would get to write another book. Mm-hmm. And that maybe that would be the big... my big contribution to the world and my big creative output in the world would be that. And it is. Do you know what I mean? That's still the thing that I... writing the books is sort of the thing that's closest to me. Do you know what I mean? Without any mediation from anyone. But I didn't expect to suddenly, at the age of, at that time, 35, go on television at all. Mm-hmm. And then to get this job, which would... you know, first, The Daily Show, which I was... you know, I'd been a huge fan and watcher of the show... you know, that's, you don't, there's no reason to think that you're going to then all of a sudden in your mid-30s, when you're, you know, not in the best shape in your life, be told to be on the show.
Hodgman, get in here!
Yeah, that would be a definition of delusion. Do you know what I mean? It was like television said, okay, come on, your turn, come on in.
John, what are you sitting around for? Well, I'm going to be on The Daily Show. All right. He thinks he's going to be on The Daily Show.
Yeah, and then to go in for this audition for this ad campaign, it's like, yeah, you know what, that'll be a fun story to tell, how I auditioned for this big ad campaign and didn't get it. You know what I mean? But then... I got the job and it ruined the story. You know? So I was very...
And you regret that every day.
I really felt like, you know, someone was going to come out of a closet at any moment and say, it's a prank show. Your life is a prank show. Go back to where you belong.
That's not uncommon, though. That emotion, I think, is very common. I think most people feel, especially if they kind of get outside their comfort zone a little bit about like getting stuff that they feel is maybe more than, for whatever reason, they think they deserve.
Right.
Which you totally make up in your head, by the way. That a lot of people feel like someone's just going to tap them on the shoulder and go, yeah, you go, what are you doing? What are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's not true because you absolutely deserve to...
Oh, that's nice of you to say. But it's... first of all, I didn't feel that way then.
Sure.
And I don't feel that way now. So those are the two exceptions to your theorem.
So you thought about this moment to meet Steve.
Yeah, Brown. So that it was just a little too weird and... the whole thing felt so nebulous and could be taken away at any moment. And I truly was afraid that if I went in there and made a bad impression or did something dumb, and I did feel like it was a little intrusive. Steve Jobs, he knows that I'm at The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. He knows how to reach me if he wants to talk to me.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be like, hey, Steve, how are you?
Now, see, there should have been, the writers of The Daily Show should have come up with the best way to present you to him. Whether it be...
Well, no, John came up with a very reasonable way that he would mention me in the office while he was meeting with Steve, take a read as to whether Steve was open to the idea of me coming in, and if he was, then they would page me and I would come in. And that was his idea.
Mm, I would have voted for... you take a desk, you cut a hole in the desk...
Right.
You take out the tube of a CRT, one of those old computer monitors, a PC monitor.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, and then you put your head through the hole, and you place the monitor on your head.
Sure.
And then John goes, "Hey, I want to show you this computer I got."
Yeah.
And then he flicks a switch, and then your head's just there, and you're
Bing
like,
bong.
"Hey, yeah. Steve, yeah. I don't work too good." Bleep, bloop, bloop, bloop. And then it's a breakaway desk, so you can stand up.
Right.
And then cast off.
But it doesn't exactly break away very well, so I spent 45 minutes trying to get out of it.
And he waits for it because he's patient. Right. And then
you walk out to him out of breath.
Yeah.
Hi, John.
Well,
and you go, you're welcome for making your product more popular, and then you fucking leave.
Yeah.
Well, you trip over the stuff that you just broke off.
It's a good idea.
You might cut him a little bit with the computer glass. But whatever, you just get out of there.
Hang on, I have to make a disgusting cough now.
Okay. Ooh, that was...
Excuse me.
Good cover-up.
can edit that.
I fully understand why that.
I just didn't know what was the right call, and so over the weekend, he was coming on Monday. We'd had this conversation on the previous Thursday, so over the weekend, I was like, I really went back and forth about it, and finally, I decided, you know what? No, Steve Jobs is there for a reason. I don't need to punk him. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And if he were interested in, I'm going to have faith that these things are going to go further forward.
Sure.
And that if he wants to meet me, he can.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided not to go. And I was explaining my rationale at dinner on Monday night to some people that I was having dinner with. And as I was explaining it, everyone was like, yeah, that makes sense. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense to me. And then something went off my head. It's like, oh, yeah, but I never told John. that was my decision.
Oh.
And even then, I wasn't like, yeah, but you know
what? You look at your phone and you have 10 texts from John. Yeah. Where are you? Steve's waiting. Yeah. He really wants to see you.
Yeah, at that point, I was like, and even then, I was like, sort of like, yeah, but you know what? I'm not the first thing on John Stewart's mind. Like,
right.
It probably didn't even come up. And so I just decided the next day, you know, I better just check in.
Yeah.
So I called Jen Flans, who's now one of the executive producers on the show and is sort of my the wonderful sane person who guides me through the show. Like, mm-hmm. And I said, "Hey, Jen, it's John." I just thought, and she was like, "Where were you yesterday?" Like, I really, so it came up, huh? She's like, "Yeah." I mean, she was laughing about it. It was like, "Yeah, we were paging you for some time."
Oh no. Yeah.
It was awful.
And you upset Steve Jobs. You upset John Stewart. Everything went away.
Yeah, yeah. It was exactly...
Again...
It was exactly the opposite of what I wanted.
I apologize for bringing this up again, but I still feel like you could have played that off to Steve Jobs, like, see, the PC is not very reliable.
Ooh. Method.
Yeah, you're a method
actor. Yeah, but I wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't fucking show up.
So how could I play that off to him?
In an adorable email?
John
or a carrier pigeon.
John Stewart smoothed it over. He was cool. Made sure it was okay with me. Thanks to his intervention, the ads continued for 3 years longer. I exchanged some very nice emails with Steve.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which was cool and nerve-wracking.
Did you pour over every word? Like, oh, does this seem like this or does this?
And how many emoticons did you use?
He had sent me an email right after the thing came out,
mm-hmm.
saying thank you, nice job, and I was like, that's weird. And I was like, this is someone pranking me.
Mm-hmm.
This is someone on the internet who, because this can't be his email address. It's too normal,
right?
And I'm going to write back to this, and then it's going to be all over some.
Nice try, fuckface.
Yeah. That blog, nice bright
face. Yeah. It's my favorite shirt too.
NTFF.
But I verified through someone, a contact at Apple, that this was actually for real. So I wrote him back. So I had his email,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote him a note that I've now written him several times, basically saying, you know, thank you. The reality is that everything that I'm really proud of that I've made in my life, I have made using an Apple product. Mm-hmm. I realized going back to my teenage years. Do you mm-hmm. know what I mean? It's like, so it really was, for me, an embarrassment of riches because they were fun to do. I thought they were creatively good. I loved my coworkers. I was happy to be associated with the brand. And they paid me money.
Yeah, my friends, my best friend's dad had in 1985 or 6 had a Mac. Yeah. Just that little standalone Mac.
Yeah.
And my stepfather had a machine running MS-DOS.
Yeah.
And just the difference between the two, I mean, I don't, maybe people are turning into an Apple commercial, but the difference of being able to use graphics and a graphical interface.
Sure.
And the, it was just like,
you know, look, I was having Mac versus PC fights with my friends. You know, when I first moved to New York in 1994, we would go to McGovern's,
mm-hmm.
a bar on Spring Street.
McGovern's?
Yeah, exactly. Where Jonathan Colton was playing the open night
Was he really?
Open mic night, yep.
Is that when you first met John?
No, no, no. I went to college with him.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we all moved to New York at the same time. Jonathan and I and a bunch of my friends from high school and college, a bunch of his friends from high school and college. And we all were, your little ravenous pack of wolves.
Like the T-Birds from Greece.
Exactly. You know, seeking sustenance in this horrible wilderness that wants to kill you, mm-hmm. known as New York City. And I think we all ganged up to force Jonathan to play at this open mic night, because that was during a period where he wasn't wanting to be a musician.
Just a software engineer.
Yeah, yeah, because mm-hmm. he had been turned off by his experience working for, I think, Angel Records.
Okay.
It was basically that album Chant, which was just... Do you remember that? It was Gregorian chants by a bunch of monks in Spain.
Oh, that was Angel Records?
Yeah, it was Angel Records. That was the big thing he worked on. He's like, if this is music publishing, I want no part.
Because he put out that album after that.
Right, of course. Yeah. And he thought all... At that time, he probably assumed every music has to be religious in nature, right. Some type of religious or spiritual chant.
No, but what he's... we're going off track here, but... have you had him on the podcast?
Yes, yes. Oh,
okay, I apologize. I missed that one.
No, that's okay. Yeah,
I listened to every podcast that Jonathan Goldman was on.
I mean...
I wouldn't have time to do anything.
Yeah, that would take up at least like 4 hours.
Yeah, so, come out today.
Colton did?
Yeah.
Oh, it came out today?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I heard some of those songs from the new album months ago at Largo.
Yeah.
I popped on to a show and Paul and Storm were there. And... they were so fucking good, and I emailed them kind of hoping that I would get a sneak. I'm like, hey, those are really great. Are those available anywhere? And he was like, oh, they're not done yet. So this actually pleases me. So by the time this podcast goes up, it'll be out.
Yeah. His covers, when he covered all the Flood songs.
Giants.
Yeah.
I like watch those videos constantly. I want those guys to put out an album of just those covers. It would just be great.
Yeah, we went and saw Flood.
You don't think so?
You want They Might Be Giants to cover
the
Jonathan
no.
Colton
you
covers?
Want Jonathan no, to
I want,
cover.
I want Jonathan and the Paul and Storm, because they're the ones that made those the cover songs. It was just it was beautiful.
Why
it was
is like the world in love again?
But like, Birdhouse in Your Soul sounded like Simon and Garfunkel playing. It was beautiful.
They're going to say like Garfunkel and Oates.
He's my, oldest and best friend. I am so, like, his... success. I mean, he worked at this company and saw how the record industry worked.
Mm-hmm.
And not only how the record industry worked, but he saw how it worked in 1994. Do you know what I mean? And he's like, this is dumb.
Yeah.
This is a stupid process.
When the music industry was still going, we're on a train that's never going to stop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
These long boxes are really awesome. This is a perfect one.
Now they come out of the bin just
right. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I'm working in Kasingles.
Yeah.
Kasingles.
Oh, those guys down at Kasingles are crazy. All they do is party all night long.
We only have to put one song on a cassette. What do you guys, we have all the free time in the world.
One of the worst things from that era of music was they tried to retain the picture disc quality of vinyl, but they would have CD picture disc, which was just an image on a disc with no sleeve in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Picture disc CD. It's like, it's just a CD with less. You got less, but paid more.
Right, exactly. So he, if there's one thing Jonathan Goldman hates, it's a dumb process.
Right.
And he just got away from it. And he was like, I don't want to be in an industry where I have to rely on these people to get my music out.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole touring structure at that time just seemed to him pointless. I mean, he also, I'm going to say revolutionized the way people approach touring in a sense by making use of these tools early, like Eventful, mm-hmm. and other sort of like audience demand tools.
And Song a Week was a genius.
Of course, yes, exactly. And like, so when the tools caught up with what he wanted to do to build an audience, to cultivate that audience, to connect with that audience, then he was ready to go out there. But until then, there was only McGovern's Tuesday nights. Late into the night, with a lot of playing of Star Trek The Next Generation pinball.
Yes.
And a lot of arguments over Mac versus PC a decade before I knew that I was going to factor into that argument in a meaningful way in the culture. Because I thought about it a lot. I mean, it really is an issue of, the people that I would fight with who are on the PC side like, these are better computers or more powerful computers, or you can get into them more, you can customize them more. And I'm like, yeah, okay, Radio Shack, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, I get that some people like to make model planes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But I, from my point of view, I remember looking at a Macintosh computer and just every cell in my body saying, I get it. Mm-hmm. Okay, I get this. Mm-hmm. And that's, it's not an issue of pure, you know, pure computing power. It's an issue of design, you know? And if you appreciate good design, it's not just how a thing looks or how shiny it is. It's how you interact with that thing.
Right.
And if you are able to interact with that thing intuitively, that's, I'm sorry, that's a big benefit.
Right.
You know? And so, anyway, so yes. So I would write Steve these MASH notes from time to time and not care if he ever read them or I just felt like I needed to express those things. And that's why I'm going to be the crazy old man at the bar who will always be talking about this ad campaign. Not just because I want those years back, but because I feel strongly about it. So I got the iPhone and I was using it and I had just gotten it set up. And of course, it was the same feeling again. It's like, why hasn't this been in my life all the time? This, mm-hmm. Everything here makes sense. This is what I've always wanted out of a device like this. And so I thought, oh, I should, now that my email is set up on my iPhone, I should write Steve. It was 11 o'clock at night on the East Coast. I was lying in bed playing with it. And I was like, well, I got the iPhone, Steve. Thank you very much. I think it's great. I know you're probably getting a lot. It was like iPhone day.
Right.
Know. I'm sure you're getting a lot of emails. So have a good day. And I'm like, well, I'm just glad I added mine to the pile.
Yep.
And I'm falling asleep. Ding, ding. I'm like, what? And I look up and it's like, it's from him. And it's like, glad you like it. What ringtone do you use?
Oh, shit.
Oh, fuck.
And I'm like, well, okay. Now I'm like, I have to sit up in bed, turn on the light. I'm like, wait a minute. Okay. There are two possibilities. One is that Steve happened to catch him, and he's now writing me back immediately. Mm-hmm. Two, he's got to be getting thousands of emails today and other messages because it was the day that it was released. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that he has either an actual or robotic assistant. You know, where it's like, this is an auto response going out.
Right.
Everyone gets the same question. What ringtone do you use? And yet, I already messed up once when I had a chance to see Steve Jobs.
Sure.
I can't stand him up again.
Right.
I can't just like, so I'm like, okay, I had to get out of bed, go over to my computer, and really think how I'm going to write a, because he asked me a direct question.
Right.
So I had to come up with some good ringtone material.
Do you just answer it? Do you make a joke? Do you answer it and then ask a question?
Yeah, right.
Do you engage him, or do you, is it just like, oh, he just wanted to know one thing?
And then, so I wrote, well, thank you for writing back so quickly and causing me this problem.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Nice to hear from you.
Thanks for the night diarrhea.
I think the best I could come up with was, I'm currently using Crickets. Mm-hmm. And it's great, but it's a little confusing because I usually walk around with about 1,000 crickets on my person, you know, actual crickets. So I don't always know whether it's a phone ringing or whether it's, you know, feeding time or whatever.
Arm is getting dark.
I usually walk around with a beard of crickets.
Or if I'm at a bad comedy show.
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, I just wanted to say thank you very much again, Steve. No need to respond.
Yep.
Sincerely yours, John Hodgman. I'm like, okay. Boop, send, get back in bed. Ding, ding. Like, oh, come on. I'm like mad. Just drop it already, Steve Jobs. It's too much. I'm not going to fall asleep now. I'm so worked up. And he just wrote back another note saying, glad you like it. I think he said that he likes ascending and descending,
mm-hmm.
that ringtone.
Uh-huh.
And I just was like, thank you again, Steve Jobs. I love you.
Dot, dot, dot.
I agree, didn't write, so should I come over?
Yeah. So, you know, And then that was it. And we had a couple of other quick email exchanges. And
so coming all around with this, the earlier point that you were making was you were coming out of these commercials, and you were coming into the Daily Show, and then you're coming into the third book. And by the time
of the third book, this whole dizzying journey that had informed the first book of like where am I now? Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that it was over, but it had slowed. It's the novelty was gone. Mm-hmm. Now I knew what I was doing to some degree. I was working on the show. I'd been working on the show, the Daily Show, for mm-hmm. At that point, 4 years, mm-hmm. and the commercials had ended. And I was I felt as though I had been washed up onto some unknown island. The ride was great getting there, but now where am I? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Why is Michael Emerson staring at me?
He must be lost. Come on. Jonah, what?
No.
Jonah, that was a show.
Don't even move. Don't return that high five.
Do not.
Even moving.
Reject. The uptalk.
Here. I'll admit, he is a person of interest.
Hey, J.J. Abrams.
Wow, a little plug for for Michael Emerson's new show. I like it.
I figured we could connect it. We'd do some favors for him, and then he can come on the show.
Has he been on the show?
No, Michael Emerson's never been on the show.
Oh, you should have him on.
Okay,
he's wonderful.
Oh, well, I'll just call him. I don't know how to get a hold of Michael
Emerson. I've had cocktails with him.
What?
Yeah.
I've been in the same bar as him once, and I wanted to go up to him, but
he's very sweet.
Yeah, that's what
he's very approachable and very nice. Really smart, because he's also a guy who he'd been working well as an actor for a number of years, but he had been a commercial illustrator for years.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. He'd been a commercial illustrator for years, and then in Florida, and rather late in his life. I don't want to say the exact age, because if I guessed it wrong, it would be embarrassing for everybody. Right. But, well into his adult life, mm-hmm. he was like, this is not for me. Then he went and became an actor. And then, so I remember seeing him on The Practice.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great run on The Practice. Not a jog, not a stroll.
Right.
A sprint.
It was a run.
Yeah.
It was definitely a run.
And then I was so excited when he showed up on Lost. And again, that was sort of like, for him, just another job. But it became, as I think he's described it, when he won the Emmy that year, like, accidentally became his life's work.
Mm-hmm.
Or he accidentally discovered his life's work, which was on that show, The Role of a Lifetime. Do you know what I mean? So he too, he's a guy who came to it. He's a guy who came to it later in his life and came to this prominence and excitement and success.
There's
at a point
more,
where he could appreciate.
There's a lot of appreciation when you haven't for so long, and then, oh, this thank
right,
you.
Yeah. Right. So I was sitting in this bookstore in Western Massachusetts, where I live sometimes in my retreat,
mm-hmm.
my survival compound in Internetless Hills, Massachusetts. one of my other many safe houses.
Yes.
And I was just feeling washed up. Do you know what I mean? Like quasi-literally. Mm-hmm. Washed up on the shore, not knowing where I am. And the ads were over, and I was mortal all of a sudden, turning 40. And I didn't know how I could write a new book of complete world knowledge, because there was this, I knew that it was going to be the last book in the series. So how do you end complete world knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, complete world knowledge never ends.
No, it does. You wrote 3 books of that.
Then I realized, so long as there is a world.
Yes.
And then I remembered, this book was going to be coming out in 2011,
mm-hmm.
which, if you own a calendar, is just a short year before 2012.
Right, when everything goes away.
When the world ends.
Right.
So then I realized, this is a book of apocalypse. of personal, professional, and global apocalypse.
That is an interesting, that's an interesting
concept. And then I remembered that from the beginning it was always going to be called That Is All. And I'm like, well, that's that. I realize now the title's been telling me the story.
Those accidental creative moments are sort of fun when it's.
Then I stopped working on it for a year. I was like, well, that's enough. I got that far.
But it's funny how sometimes I've made a couple decisions in the past few years where I sort of felt like, I don't know why I'm really doing this. I just feel like I'm compelled to do this.
Yeah.
And my manager, my friend Alex, said something to me which always resonated, which is, your gut is smarter than your brain. You will do things sometimes and you don't know why. I mean, yeah. I guess that's sort of Malcolm Gladwell's whole like blank thing. But
sure.
But just the idea of your gut.
Well, he has a brain, an extra brain.
He has a gut brain. Yeah, he has a special gut brain that he has.
He's a hind
quarter.
Like the ood.
Like the ood. He has to hold it in his. All right. He has to hold his other.
Yeah. All right, nerds, don't drive into a pole. Get back on the road.
He has an anterior gut brain, which informs a lot of his decision making. And the trick with the gut brain is not to shit it out.
But are you speaking metaphorically now, or are you speaking literally?
Medically,
yeah, yes, right, exactly.
Very, very dangerous.
Can you ask a question?
You got to hold it in.
Quato when it comes out.
Quato?
Quato.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice try.
Fuck.
Open your mind, Mr. Quaid.
Quaid.
But yes, it's absolutely true. And, you know, it's like, to me, that made perfect sense.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, now I understand what I'm writing about, which is my death, the end of human civilization, and the death of every human on the planet. Right?
Just all that.
Except it turns out for Stephen King. He makes it. He makes it through.
Of course.
In my imagination.
Does Richard Bachman.
I didn't think about that. Should have had Stephen King fight Richard Bachman on the ruined plains of the cursed earth.
Genius.
Well.
In Bangor, Maine.
In Bangor, Maine.
Yeah.
No, what happens in my book is that so in the previous book I had done Today in the Past, which was a page a day calendar in the margins of the main body of the text, where I talked about a fake fact of history in each day, like this day in history, but fake. So for this one, I did Today in the Future, or more specifically, Today in Ragnarok.
Okay.
And like a day-by-day account of the last year of human civilization.
Okay.
And what happens. And one of the things that happens long after the Omega Pulse, long after the Blood Wave, long after the arrival of the Ancient and Unspeakable Ones, who rise from their slumberless sleep beneath the waves to drown the world in their saliva.
Right.
Stephen King wakes up in Bangor, Maine, around early November, and just has this flash of inspiration in the same way, and just, you know, writes 700 new pages of The Stand.
Of course.
Like, he's like, oh,
in a day.
I forgot. This had to be part of it, too.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. And then the next day, he realizes that there are all the publishing houses have fallen, and so there's no way to publish books anymore, so he has to take the manuscript onto the road, and he has to walk the wretched remains of America.
Like the Book of Eli?
And go door to door to read.
Which I assume I didn't see that movie.
Yeah, I think he's protecting a book too.
Yeah.
But he has to go door to door to read the new manuscript pages of The Stand to all remaining Americans.
But do those people then go, Dreamcatcher was kind of weird?
I think they're just freaked out that Stephen King is showing up. Do you know what I mean?
Because after that settles down, they go, wow, hello, you're here.
Yeah, they're like, we're having a problem with cannibal gangs right now. We don't need you.
Well, I really have some interesting tales to tell you.
Yeah, I don't think the first version of The Stand and then the extended version of The Stand, that were not complete.
Well, my book is about a carpenter who came along and just an ordinary Joe wanted
Aaron.
To change the world.
Aaron,
no,
Aaron,
Bob Vila.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I thought it was Property Brothers.
Was.
You see that show? Have you seen Property Brothers on HGTV?
Oh, more reality shows of people trying to do stuff. What do they do? They buy defaulted properties?
No, here's the thing. They're identical twins.
Oh!
Yeah. They both have huge eyebrows. One of them dyes his hair blonde, so you can tell them apart.
Okay.
They're brothers. One of them is a real estate agent. The other one is a licensed contractor.
Sure.
They find people in Canada. This is a Canadian show.
Sure.
As most shows are on HGTV.
Which is weird, isn't it?
It's really weird.
Like,
House flipping. In Toronto, usually.
Yeah. Because it costs $10 to shoot stuff in Canada.
Hang on, another disgusting cough coming. I've been a little under the weather.
That's all right. All I heard was the mug.
Yeah, and I'm pretty
good. Can I have some more coffee, please, John? It's all done?
It's all done.
Okay. That's probably for the best.
Sorry.
That's okay. I hope you enjoyed yours.
Yeah, I did. I really did.
How many cups did you have exactly?
Two. I had two cups. I had two cups.
Yeah.
You had one earlier, and then I gave you another one. I freshened you up.
So two and two?
It's two and two.
Yeah. Did you ever top yours off?
Mm-mm-mm. No, I think maybe I fill it up, and then I drink it down, and then I filled it back up, and I drank it down.
Now, the sad thing is, I think we're all going to admit that these are diminutive cups.
They're tiny. I'm very large. I'm a big guy.
Yeah, he needs a lot of coffee to keep going.
Anyway.
I'm sorry, John.
It's okay. It's fine.
So Stephen King's going door to door.
Stephen King is going door to door, reading The Stand to people, mm-hmm. and then encounters a psychic child.
Okay.
And he's like, I knew you guys were out there. I knew you guys were real. I knew you telepaths were telepathic gifted children.
We weren't. It was only until after the fall of humanity.
Yes, exactly. So, but that is just but one of the storylines that runs through the margins of the book.
And so that is all. This will go up way in advance of November 1st, and that comes out November 1st.
Yes, but it is available for pre-order now mm-hmm. on all the major websites.
Yep.
And then it comes out November 1st, and then I will be coming to a town near you, I hope. I know. I'll be coming to a town near you.
I mean, you've already made that happen, right?
On November 4th.
Oh, I'll be in New York then.
You will?
Yeah, because my book comes out November 1st too, and so I am going.
But isn't that better though? That, like, what if we were both doing book events on November 4th in L.A.? That would be awkward.
Yeah, that would be really awkward. I would just crash yours because you'll have more people come to yours.
I don't know that that's so.
Yeah, I think that's so.
You got it together on your website, man. Let me tell you.
Hey, man. This is a groovy links and shit pointing at stuff.
No. What? Tell me about your book. Let's plug your book, man.
No, we don't have to plug my book.
But tell me about it.
It's a productivity book for nerd-brained people. Creative obsessive types.
Yeah.
Like people who... I get irritated a lot because people say, like... you don't talk about video games on your podcast. That's not very nerdy. And I'm like, guys, that is almost a racist view of what it meant if such a thing could exist, if nerds were a race.
Right.
It is being nerdy to me is not about if you watch Battlestar, Star Wars, or you read Walking Dead, or you know, any. It's not about what you consume. It's about the way. It's not about what you like. It's how you like those things.
How you approach.
There's a very specific brand mindset that I feel like nerdy people have, which is that, you know, we have this ability to focus on things to almost an unhealthy degree.
Right.
And sometimes that gets in the way of things that we should be doing. We're good right. small picture people. Sometimes we're not good big picture people.
Right.
And we suffer from a lot of anxiety and depression. And so it's just a lot of, look, here's... See, this guy's so fucking nerdy.
You know me so much.
Look how nerdy this guy is. Look how nerdy this guy is. So the idea is just that, you know, in my 30s, when I kind of got my shit together, I... used the sort of innate unhealthy focusing abilities and just sort of redirected that laser into constructive areas.
Sure.
And so I feel like, you know, all nerds have this innate ability to focus on things, and here are some ways that I was able to sort of conquer that and get over some of those things. And we're overthinkers, and if we can just get out of our way, if we can get out of our own way, sometimes we can actually accomplish things.
Are you teaching nerds how not to be nerds?
No, I'm teaching nerds how to hone. I'm teaching much in the way that Cyclops was given the goggles, which I'm sure have a name that I don't know. Goggles.
I'll say goggles. Visor.
The visor. Yeah, yes. Visor. Yes. Just like Geordi.
Right. Exactly.
But in neither
case is that a visor, right? A visor is like something you wear.
In Geordi's case, it was really a hairband.
Hairband.
That
has he been on your podcast?
No, LeVar. No, yeah. He hasn't.
Well, that's ridiculous.
But I want to get him. Sure. I want to get him on too. Nice. So anyway, that's my book, and it's coming up the same day.
And what is the title of the book?
The Nerdist Way.
The Nerdist Way. Mm-hmm. I like it very much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I'm very excited.
I hope people don't hate it, but I can't control that.
Yeah, well, that's, you know.
But I'm building a machine that will. If I can bring the Earth closer to Earth. Or...
you can affect people's brains.
I can affect people's brains.
Force them to like your book.
Yes. But there's something that I want to do as we wrap up the podcast.
Yeah.
A few years ago, our mutual friend Jesse Thorne, who
yes.
was the Sound of Young America, Jordan Jesse Go, a brilliant... does he refer to himself as a raconteur?
I don't know.
Seems like you would.
He's a multi-hyphenate.
A podcast mogul.
Yes.
Yeah. Coughing coming.
Where was
Pardon me.
Do it now.
Do it.
Okay.
Okay.
When we did Max FunCon,
yes,
up in the isolated mountains of California,
right,
where we almost died driving up through billows of fog,
yes,
billows and pillows
at the UCLA Conference and Retreat Center. Yep. Then it was known as that.
Yeah,
now it is known as Hodgman's Compound Number 5.
I thought it was Max Fun Camp. That's
yeah. Well, I liked it so much.
You bought a safe compound.
Yeah. I could use this.
There was a safe town.
There was night, like yeah. one of my fondest.
I'm also buying the Port Marion resort village in Wales where they shot the prisoner.
He's not really buying it. I wish you would. I've always wanted to go there.
I just lead the humble, simple life. Now that my ads are over,
I'm just going to buy the village
of a deranged millionaire.
Which you did for the They Might Be Giants video series.
Yes.
You played the crazy billionaire.
That was the deranged millionaire was my character then, as it is now.
Yes.
Yes.
I like that a life has imitated art in that way.
Yes.
And that you now have the ability to...
The weirdness became... Look, I don't want to talk about my finances, but no. I have millions of dollars in this room.
To play around in this room.
And I can buy Port Marion just like that.
That would be amazing. Now, am I a number or am I a free man?
Hang on. Put on this blazer with wide white piping.
Oh, sure.
Yes, you look more like a number 39.
Oh, no, that's not good. Right. That puts me low on the totem pole. Yeah.
Well,
how many people are there? You don't know that.
Be seeing you.
We're at Max FunCon.
One of my favorite experiences in my life, and I mean this sincerely... after we did our shows for the night and all the campers gone to bed, you were in this great little cabin house, and it was you and Colton and Merlin Mann and another friend of ours named Scott Simpson,
yes,
and Mike Furman,
yes,
and we played the game that you brought to our attention, which when I met Justin Long, I told him about it, and he goes, Hodgman got that from me.
Yes, I did.
So
I credited him then, too.
I couldn't remember.
Justin Long, on the set of the Apple ads, introduced this game. I don't even know it has different names, but the names are dumb, so I'm not going to...
Sure.
But the idea is that you find movie titles.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you could use...
Any titles.
Novels, plays, sure. Musicals.
Sure.
That could be taken as a euphemism for defecation.
Yes, and we played that game for about 3 hours.
Probably, I think the one that best exemplifies this is the movie Operation Jumbo Drop.
The Double Drop,
right?
The elephant movie.
The elephant movie, or euphemism for defecation.
We played that game, and I went to bed, and I couldn't shut it off. I could not shut it off. And I played this game with Colton when he came on the podcast.
Oh, right. Okay.
Grease was one of my favorites. Black Dynamite was another one.
Oh.
The Green Mile.
Yeah. Black Snake Moan.
Yep. Rock of Ages.
Oh.
What?
I don't like it.
That thing you do?
Oh.
Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire.
That's not yours.
I don't know. I don't know if it is. I think maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, you came up with it.
I guess I did.
Oh. Why do we have to do this?
Bug and CERN, John Leguizamo.
Oh, right. The pest.
That's when it just doesn't let go.
Let's see.
I'm sure the brown bunny would have come up at some
point. Brown bunny, yeah.
Trying to think of some
Brown Bunny's really long and boring, and you don't really get much out of it when you're done.
That's right.
You guys are gross. I started this?
And Chloe Sevigny will blow you.
I'm trying to think, what are some... let me just focus on the realm of musicals. Musical theater.
Well, now I'm way out of my depth there. I don't really know.
Avenue Q doesn't work. Book of Mormon doesn't work.
No.
Carousel, no.
Young Frankenstein?
Young Frankenstein. We're getting somewhere there. The Who's Tommy?
Yes. I like throwing the who in front of
me. Yeah.
Well, that's how it was on Broadway. Who's Tommy?
Just Tommy. Just naming it. Just giving it a name.
So
albums are a pretty good one to do as well. You do Nevermind when you think you're going to go and you don't.
I like the explanation of it.
I like the explanation too. It's fun.
I don't know any album titles. Number one, The Beatles' Greatest Hits.
Number one. Well, that's either number two. Would be okay, musical theater isn't working for me. What else is out there?
But books.
Books.
Hey, that is all.
Oh, thank you.
Also the area of expertise.
Available November 1st.
Should be November 2nd.
Should be. Yeah, that's a good place to wrap it up.
I pooped another one out, everybody. It's only my life's work.
a little bit of brain poop.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I'm sorry that I wasn't more productive on the pooping jokes.
I think you did an amazing job.
Look, I did what I could. I feel like there's one great musical out there. Oklahoma? No. What's the one that I'm thinking of? Lion King? Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
Wicked?
Wicked. No. Musicals are
Guys
surprisingly...
and Dolls?
No, it doesn't work. You would think. Musicals are surprisingly poop-proof.
Yeah, they really are.
So they made a...
Maybe one of your listeners will send in some suggestions.
Oh, I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm sure we'll get some good musicals.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
I don't... That's perfect!
There you go.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
Oh, boy. That took a lot out of me.
It probably feels like you just passed a huge...
Whoa.
Oh, my
really,
God.
Really took a Godfather, though.
Okay, well...
Right now, your
Godfather
brain is...
Part two.
Your brain is distended a little bit from pushing. You need a minute to recover.
How did this become this? How did this become this? That's my next
thing. Nervous podcast.
Yeah, and we're in your safe suite. We're in your panic suite.
I'm in the panic suite.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for coming over.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
My feral boner right will show you out.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, please, put me down.
Take them out.
And don't kill John Hodgman.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Don't.
Please don't.
If you meet me on the road, say hello. Don't kill me.
Kill him with kindness.
Exactly.
Well, don't overstay your welcome.
Yeah, well, yeah. Just say hello and don't touch me in any way.
No, please don't. Yeah. Don't manhandle or touch the Hodgman.
Exactly so. Good. Thank you. Good night. That is all.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by GoToMeeting, now with HD faces. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and enter the promo code Nerdist.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.